Listen on Demand, brought to you by 680 News.
Pete, first I got to say thank you very much for doing this interview with me. I was one of the lucky folks a couple of years ago who had a chance to go from Toronto to L.A. to see The Who perform at the Staples Center, one of the best shows I've ever seen. Before we start talking about the book, I got to ask you, when you look at your career musically, how do you feel knowing that yourself, your band has been able to contribute to music the way it has, so legendary?
Well, obviously, the legend bit, it's not something that I focus on too much. So, you know, really, from my point of view, the joy was in, you know, the writing the music and developing the music over the period. But, you know, I think if you read the book, you'll see that, you know, a lot of it was very, very hard graft, and not all of it was enjoyable. But, you know, ultimately, it was a good thing. You know, I don't fall quite so easily as most performers into just celebrating what's gone before. I feel The Who have been forced to celebrate because we did such innovative work in the early days, and because, hey, you know, we invented, or we helped to invent, the rock anthem. So we ended up with, you know, a number of songs that are the backbone of rock. You know, this has happened to other performers as well, like the Stones and Bruce Springsteen. And if you don't play those songs, you know, you don't play those songs, and it leaves a hole in every performance.
Well, you know, let's get right into the let's talk about the book, because what you just mentioned is so true. The difficulties in being who you are and how you had to develop as a musician. I mean, when you think about it physically, mentally, your body was abused to be able to create the art. And of course, we're going to get into the drugs and the drinking too. But when you think about that, though, the survival part for you, I mean, what do you think helped you survive? I know it's in the book, but I want to hear it from you, though.
The drinks and the drugs helped. You know, for a long time, not so much the drugs. You know, I ended up using drugs because I was trying to stop drinking. I went through a very common route, you know, of if you read the book, you'll see, taking prescription medicine to try to stop, you know, using alcohol and ending up caught up in drugs themselves. So, you know, but alcohol for me was a really good medicine. You know, it's just that I think, you know, I do have an addictive nature or an obsessive nature, and in the end it stopped working for me, and that was a bad day.
And you're right,
because, you know, I loved to drink, I loved the way it made me feel socially, and the other stuff, the other physical difficulty, you know, I don't know that it was entirely physical. I think it was emotional. That really, when you read my book, what you'll see is that I was trying to live two lives. I was trying to be two people, and they were definitely the same guy, but one was a family man with a terrific wife and a couple of great kids and a very simple family home. You know, my parents were alive. I had two little brothers. My wife's family were terrific. My father-in-law was a composer, film for TV and film. You know, life was good when I was at home. I had a studio in the house. I could write songs and walk the dog and have a normal life. And then suddenly I was out on the road. And I wasn't just out on the road so I missed my family. I was out on the road with Keith Moon. And his way of handling whoever it was that he was to start trouble, and trouble tended to follow us everywhere, and you either joined in or you stood back and just allowed yourself to get arrested every couple of weeks. So in a sense, sometimes I joined in and sometimes I didn't join in, but I found it emotionally very difficult to make the change. Now, I was quite happy to be paid, and it was an okay life, but not as good as it is today, I hasten to say. I'm talking to you from the most beautiful hotel in Ritz-Carlton in Montreal, And they've just done it up, and it's very, very beautiful. And I'm sitting here thinking about the other beautiful hotel in Montreal that we smashed up in 1978 and all ended up in prison. You know, thank God those days are gone. And I can enjoy the life that I have these days. But, you know, that it was emotional rather than physical.
And that emotion can, and correct me if I'm wrong, because addiction really started, was in your family.
Well, that's an easy escape, isn't it? The what Berkowitz called the abuse excuse. You know, we either blame the fact that we're Irish, so we drink a lot, or we're Jewish, so we eat a lot, or something. There's always an excuse. And yeah, there was some addiction issues and substance abuse issues in my family. Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Keith Moon because, I mean, of course, that hit everybody hard. But you talk about how your reaction and how you dealt with that. You know, again, I guess something that still to this day is a horrible memory for you.
Yeah. You know what was so awful, really? It wasn't a shock because, you know, we'd all been expecting Keith to die for such a long time. But what was a shock in the months that it happened, the months leading up to it and beyond it, was the fact that he was getting better. He was starting to get well. You know, he was calling me every night and we were chatting and he was, you know, he was sober and drug free, but he, you know, abused prescription medicines and that's what killed him. It's ironic after all those years of, you know, Keith would take anything you gave him. He would never check what was on the label. And he survived and survived and survived and survived and then goes to get medical help. And, you know, within 3 months, he was dead. And, you know, it says a lot for rehab. You know, I think these days we kind of know what to do. You know, when Keith was trying to get well, my experience being involved with, I wouldn't say that I helped, but I certainly learned a lot from being involved with being Eric Clapton's friend when he was dealing with his issues in 1973, 72, 73. So when it came to work with Keith around 75, 76, 77, 78, rehab as we know it today was just starting to come together. You know, I think I can't remember when the Betty Ford Clinic started, but it was probably around that time. You know, we didn't really know how to treat people, but what they needed was not to be locked up in a room and the key thrown away. You know, addiction is not, it has shades of insanity. There's no question about it, but Keith Moon was not insane. He had this kind of belief that he was indestructible, which was crazy, you know. And yeah, it was a shock because he seemed to be doing so well, and then suddenly he was gone. And I made a very strange decision, you know, instead of just letting the Who go and getting on with a solo career or doing something else, I kind of decided in a bizarre way that somebody needed to fill his shoes. I don't mean literally, but I felt, you know, we all missed him. We all missed his humor. We all missed his chaos. We all missed his energy. And for a while, I did try to fill his shoes, and nobody could do that. It didn't work for me. Didn't work for him, and it didn't work for me either.
One of the things I do have to talk about, because reading this book, I was wondering if I was going to lead up to it. And, of course, the, you know, seizing of your computer and reading about what happened, because I did not know the outcome of everything. I heard about when your computer was seized and what they accused you of, but I never heard about what the outcome was, honestly, until I read the book.
Yeah. Well, the best thing to do, if you give a damn about me, is to read the book, because it's a long story. And you know, how I got caught up in this whole business was, you know, as an activist, really, rather than as a user of pornography on the internet. You know, I don't have a big pitch. You know, I don't take a moral stand on what goes on the internet, but you know, since I saw it coming back in 71, 72, I was one of those people that could, that kind of knew the internet was coming. You know, I'd been taught about the coming of computers at art school back in the early 60s, and I could just see that the internet was something that was going to happen. And of course, my main concern was what it would do, whether it would help or destroy the music industry. And we are in the middle of finding out what the result of that is. But there was another thing going on, which was that I was very much involved in what I would call domestic recovery, the recovery of and support for people that were abused physically, usually women by their violent husbands. And ironically, in many cases, by their violent, loving husbands, getting the law changed in the UK so that it was the same as the law in Canada, which is that the police have the responsibility to decide whether to charge the violent husband or not. And in the background, a whole bunch of kids who were quite clearly incredibly scarred by domestic violence. Now, I'd been involved in that since 1974-75. And when the internet started to show shades of a new kind of abuse, which was not the photos necessarily of the abuse of children, that's bad enough, but the very idea that this was something that people that had suffered abuse, and I had suffered my own particular abuse as a child, would be really scarred by the idea that anybody would want to see this stuff, that anybody would want to enjoy it, that anybody, but worse than that was the fact that it seemed that nobody was really doing anything about it because of the fact that it was selling newspapers. The whole issue was selling newspapers. So I saw myself as a bit of a white knight, and I think if you read the book, you'll see how that went wrong for me. Quite a few of my best laid schemes have gone badly wrong. Happily, it's turned out okay for me in the long haul. You know, the book has been a chance to not only to explain the background, but since I've written the book, you know, a number of events have happened that have made me feel even more confident. Not, you know, I don't want to get cocky about this. You know, this lesson for me was a lesson in humility. You know, I had to realize that this was a battle that I couldn't win. I would never be able to change the way that people thought about me. It would always be something that would be in their mind when they saw my face. And whether they believed I was completely innocent or partially innocent or totally guilty or partially guilty, it changes nothing for me in my day-to-day life. You know, I know what happened, and I know why what happened happened. And if you read the book, you can make up your mind.
Well, I think it's an incredible book, and I know we're going to have to wrap this up, but before we go, you guys are going to be performing here in Toronto. And as I said, I had a chance a couple of years ago to see you guys in the Staples Center. For some folks who have never had a chance to see The Who live, what kind of show is it going to be?
Well, it's going pretty good. You know, for years, for a number of years, for maybe even for three or four, certainly since we did the Super Bowl, I've been trying to persuade Roger to come out with me and perform Quadrophenia as a set piece. The last time we did it was in 1996. When the album came out in 1973, we never ever performed it in its entirety. When we did it in 1996-97, we did a long tour and a lot of shows. I very much enjoyed it, but one of the things that I enjoyed most about it was that it is my favorite Who album. It's the one I'm most proud of, but also it's one that when we do this show, we don't have to do, you know, an hour and a half of really loud rock and roll. You know, a lot of the music is quite subtle, and it means that I can play this show without damaging my hearing any more than I have already, and just play the music. And this time around, Roger eventually agreed and to do this with me now, and on the condition that he would be allowed to create a new video presentation for it. And the video presentation avoids the narrative. It avoids trying to tell the story of Jimmy, who, you know, has a bad day and ends up on a rock in the rain, and just decorates the music visually. And I was skeptical that it was going to work as well as it has, but it works incredibly well. And I'm really loving performing the music. And then we do, after we've played Quadrophenia, which is so far every show has been a complete smash, we then play some old hits and stretch out and have fun and then say goodbye. It's gone very, very well. It's the right kind of show for two old guys like us to be doing.
Well, you know what? Add in a third old guy. You're going to add me into that, too, because, like I said, I cannot wait for the show.
Oh, good, really. Great. Thanks a lot.
Peter, thank you so much for this. And, like I said, incredible book. And I really hope a lot of people get to read it, because whatever is on the internet that's about your life doesn't come close to what is in these pages. Thank you again, Pete, for the interview.
Thanks, Rudy.
Take care.